Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
Hello, people. In this episode, we speak to Mike Paul about the importance of modularity, scalability, and interoperability. I'm glad I didn't get that wrong. Mike Paul is the managing director for EMEA Innate. As managing director of Europe, Middle East, and Africa business operations at Innate, Mike Paul leads marketing and sales efforts while defining and driving the growth of digital solutions that fuel customer success. Directly preceding his current role, Mike was vice president of industry solutions, acting as the liaison between clients in the industry and Innate's sales and development team in over 20 countries on five continents. Dale, how did you find that episode, mate? We went all over the place. It was great.
We did. It was great. Well, first off, I'm glad you had to read out the title and not me, because between a South African Australian, it was a mouthful. I've got to put my teeth back in. But no, it was great. Mike's always fantastic. I've spoken to him numerous times offline, and it was great to get him on the podcast to share his views. He's obviously been with Innate for a long, long time. And often, you know, when you've been with an organization that long, you see everything through that lens. But he does a great job at also taking the Innate hat off and sharing openly and freely his views, which is fantastic too. I think I particularly liked his views on the pros and cons of, you know, scaling fast and slow, and what, you know, people look out for, what modularity actually means and the advantages thereof. But I guess we also dipped our toe into the future, and he shares openly about, you know, where he thinks we could improve. And I think the listeners will be surprised that he doesn't talk about AI in terms of the future. So, yeah, one to look out for. What about you, Val?
Yeah, I'm with you, man. I think we talked about actual projects on the ground. It's great to have someone who also has worked in projects and has a background in that space as well, not just software, because then otherwise it can feel like a bit of a plug. But he's got a lot of energy. He talks about a lot, and a lot of it's experiential, and we go into the what if as well, which is great. You know, what can we do better on construction projects, not just from a software perspective, but from a people and a culture perspective, which I thought was great.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. Look, folks, as we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast, episode 180. Can't believe it. Cannot believe it. Mr. Dale, it was great to see you in the Middle East, buddy, for the Dubai Expo. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Val. I hope you're not missing me yet. I mean, it was only a week or so ago that we saw each other. But yeah, just a little bit. Fair enough. I'll send you a picture maybe or something. Send you a video. Mike, videos of myself every day.
But it's great. We actually did our first presentation together, even though we've known each other for many, many, many years. Our guests were like this too. We were standing up on stage together for the first time. It went reasonably well, I thought. So it was good to do something special with you, mate. But let's introduce our guest, no stranger to projects, Mr. Mike Paul. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderful, guys. How are you today?
So good. So good. It's still slightly summer in Melbourne, so we're getting a bit of sun, which is great. But you can see the weather's turning already. So, Mike, I'm not looking forward to the cold. But we've been talking just offline about projects and everything in between. But, Mike, I would love to know where it all started for you, mate. How did you fall into projects?
Well, you know, most of my growing up, I wanted to be an architect. So I was kind of always into construction and structures. And my father was a civil engineer, but I kind of wanted to go the architecture route and did all my studies heading up to university. And I was in the university program of architecture for 2 months, and it was not my thing. And so I went to the dean and asked what to do. And he said, any chance you're good at math and science? And I said, I'm great at math and science. He goes, go be a civil engineer. There's a lot more jobs. Build it on that side. So I got redirected, got into civil engineering. And I kind of, for about 10 years out of school, was a journeyman, if you will, in the heavy civil world. So I was bridges and roads and highways and you know, even subdivisions, but really about the concrete and the flat work and the horizontal side, as we'd say. And then I had moved to Arizona, and I stumbled into this company called Hard Dollar that was the original company of an eight that was selling estimating and project controls solutions. And I just kind of walked up and was able to get myself a job, you know, as an engineer working for a software company in 2003. That sounded an interesting approach. We'd been around 15 years at that time, or 14 years. And I stayed with them for 4 years. I then left, went into work for another construction company. And next thing I know, I found myself managing some supply chain and some construction project finance and program development in the Middle East and Africa. And I did that. Boy, between 2009 and 2013, I spent a lot of, or actually about 2015, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East and Africa doing that. Things kind of hit up against a wall with some changes in governments, some energy prices, and I reached out to my old company, Hard Dollar, and they had been acquired. They renamed themselves. They became an eight, and I was able to walk back on board and I'd play a variety of roles there, and now I'm managing director for Innate for Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. So always been in this sort of business. It's fun as anything to be on the technology side, but to still be able to play in the sandbox with everybody else and walk the jobs and meet the people and feel like I'm still part of it.
That's awesome, because when we do have people come on and we talk about software and applications for projects, the ones I think I get along with the most are the ones that have been on the other side of the fence, the ones that have actually got project battle scars, they've been out there in the muck. Because as you know, working on projects is never clean. And so if you're someone who's come from theory or the art of theory, and you go and apply those principles to projects, there is a massive gap. Yeah?
Oh, 100%. Matter of fact, I'd say that's one of the unique things my group brings out there is that we have over 500 employees, but over half of them former project managers, construction managers, PMPs, civil engineers, mechanical industrial engineers. We even have some architects. And I think they saw what I saw as, well, how fun to be involved in big projects, but do it from a different side. And so when I'm working at the beginning of a sale or just meeting with a client for the first time, it's immediate that I understand I've been there. Many of our people were implementing our software or implemented and worked with our competitor software, but they understand a lot of the pains they're going through, what an implementation's like, what challenges they are, old systems they're working with. And I think it's unusual and unexpected, but it's a bright spot when they come in and say, oh my gosh, you literally have done that. Okay, come over here and help me understand why I'm not getting good feedback on productivities. And my data is showing me I'm losing money, but it doesn't look that way. And we can say, well, let me tell you my experience. And I think that is, especially in construction, experience is everything. Textbook, whatever. Training, okay, but experience is what wins over the respect in the industry. So we pride ourselves in that. I'm really excited, and I go in confidently that I'll learn something, but I'd also might teach something too.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that sentiment. I think I used to think of like construction as organizations, but now I think it's more like tribes. So they do. They hand these stories down, and particularly big construction organizations. I think we had Dave Snowden talking about Lang O'Rourke having a particular story about a crane, and that was passed down through management to the new starters, you know, as a kind of a lessons learned. But it's great to have you on board, because I think we had a really interesting title. And just to kick in the subject matter, because I think we had some nominations of words, and I want to get some definitions before we dive deep, Mr. Mike. Modularity, sure. Scalability, and interoperability. I mean, for South African and Australian, some hard words you're throwing at us there. What does that mean to you, Mike? And how does the audience understand what you're talking about?
Well, it first means I have a dictionary and a thesaurus, and I'm very creative. find out a different way to say something else. So, no, I actually, the title itself, from when it was mentioned, I wrote a blog in, I want to say maybe November, with this exact title. And what it was a culmination of some lessons, my lessons learned in the last year in talking to just customers in the industry that are looking for technology, right? There was a long history 20 years ago where maybe the biggest people in the business, biggest companies wanted to do stuff. Technology wasn't there. They built their own in-house systems. And then there were some platforms and solutions out there where you bought them and then you customized everything with them. There are people that were using individual pieces and bits and best of breed single source solutions, but nothing really communicated. And what I've really picked up on is that, and last year was an interesting year in the technology side of the business, because everyone kind of pulled back a bit. Inflation, construction projects, governments, there were a lot of reasons why there was a reduction, I think, in the overall industrial spend in the technology piece. And as many of these periods do, they force people to look back again at their decisions and they realize, I need something. That's not stopping. Projects keep coming at me, but what am I going to do? And one of the things came out was these other investments, some of these approaches, they either have systems that don't talk to each other, or they're big, massive investments or in-house developments that are just huge and take forever to get value. And the idea of modularity is I might want to take off one small chunk at a time. It's the whole, you know, eat an elephant, right? One bite at a time. You can't just say, I want to be digitally transformed. That's, I think, a misnomer and has created some dissatisfaction, because that is a holistic concept that never ends, really. So they never feel like they've reached the finish line. Modularity says, look, I was thinking when I was reading How Big Things Get Built, that Bent Luvyard book, and one of his comments that he had in there that really stuck with me was, and it's the last planner model, but it's working. What is it you really want? Yes, you want to remodel your kitchen, but talk more about the purpose of it. Well, if you look at that from a digital transform perspective, it's why am I digitally transforming? Something did it. Is it just better reporting? Is it connectivity? Whatever. And so you work backwards. And then as soon as you do that, you want to see some results. You want to invest and see results. And modularity allows you to fit with a budget. So, hey, let's do a few pieces at a time. Let's show management or the client quick wins so that we're investing this. And, hey, we're going to show you right away. You don't have to wait till all the parts are in to fly this helicopter. We can already start using it right away. And so I think modularity in our sense says, hey, I know I have an end goal and it's going to allow me to do all my wishes, but I want to have some wins along the way. And it's living in the house before it's complete, but at least I've got a bedroom and I got a roof over my head. So I really think that's an important thing, and it's helping people recognize their investment faster and show their boss that it was a smart move. Look, we're already getting this out of it. So that's where I go when I think of modularity in my business.
Yeah, now, awesome.
I was going to say that scalability and the interoperability are just extensions. So I've got several clients last year that their approach was, hey, Mike, let's start out, and I want to focus on these three business processes right now. These are the most important things, field productivity and better tendering or whatever they may be. But I want to do so many more things. So we focus on those, and then we only start with that, and then they move on to the next phase. Well, sometimes the next phase is, I'm not ready to add more business processes and more tools. What I'd like to do is scale it out. So maybe we started on a project. Now I want to add more projects. So the scalability says, can I repeat this? It's modular housing. I can build this over and over again. We can do that, right? So you can produce then scale it to allow you to grow. You don't have to feel like I'm buying a company-wide solution that's going to take years. No, let's just focus on a core team or a project and scale it up. Right. And then the interoperability says, okay, now I'm seeing all these wins and I'm growing it through my organization. Can I start to connect to my other systems? Initially, everything's still disconnected or some of the old way. But as you phase it in modularly and scale it up, now we can start connecting to ERPs and 3D modeling tools and whatever the connectivity is. So it almost just explains a few year transition of a really smart implementation. Start small, phase it in, grow it, and then connect everything else. And that's becoming a trend. And that's why I wrote the blog at the end of last year.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Mike, if I jumped in there just listening to you. And we all know that there's many triangles in projects. You know, we were like the golden triangle, the iron triangle. There's lots of different triangles. Val loves triangles. He always drew triangles when we work together. Triangles and circles. Sure. I don't know. Yeah. But one of the triangles we know and love, and there's different versions of these, but they're all similar, are people, processes, and technology. And I guess you're touching primarily on technology for obvious reasons. But I want to know, though, does the people and processes side, does modularity, scalability, and interoperability also apply? You know, culture, behaviors, all these types of things. Because we know in isolation, absolutely, tech works, right? Tech works. It works well, and we know these things. So you can scale them up, down, whichever, which way. But I want to know, in your experience, when it comes to people and processes and the culture around using these tools, and also, I guess, capability, are those things modular? Are those scalable?
They certainly are. That's actually a great question, almost like you read my notes. We often refer to it as three P's, right? People, process, product. That's us just spinning on the word technology. But yes, absolutely. So one of the ways that it works from our side is as we are implementing, many of us, as stated earlier, come from the industry. So our people take pride and bring a value to this process that isn't just an uncertain, tell me what I need to do from a technology perspective. It's really, let's walk me through your challenges and let's look at a few ways to do it. That's the people on our side. But on the other side, what this allows you to do is go in and find some internal change champions, right? Change management at any implementation is tough. I haven't found one where they're 100% on board. You can find some that can absolutely end what looked like a good vision because of it. So one of the things we did a lot of looking at last year was how to improve end user adoption and thus reduce change management. And one of them is their people. Get a few winners. Sometimes it's some of the younger, newer people that aren't obligated or married to other approaches and says, I'd like to see what's great out there. What can we do? And you do this modular approach with that team, and those people become champions. And that initial win, if you want to call it that, gets credibility for the decision, credibility for the solution and technology that was bought, and for whatever processes were implemented. And now maybe you can show a win and say, hey, I got a big project going on right now. That bridge I'm building, I'd love to have an opportunity to reduce my risk or improve my productivity. Get me that. And so the modularity and scalability absolutely play into the people and the process side. So I think technology, if done right, can help you with those three pieces.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they're all interlinked, right? And it's mm-hmm. I think it's good for those listeners hearing this from you going, actually, yeah, it is. It is all interlinked. And we need to ensure that, you know, we do this in harmony and union. Otherwise, you'll have one that's like up here and then the others are catching up, and that's no good to anyone. The return investment will probably not reap its rewards. The other one right. I had though for you was, I guess, in terms of listening to what you're saying in terms of modularity, it's almost sort of these marginal gains. You take people along the journey with you. But have you experienced ever where there's a light switch moment? I mean, we've had previous guests here on change management, which you just brought up as well. And there's different views on whether or not you go slow and incremental changes and bring people along the journey, or actually, you know, there are opportunities to just light switch and go, actually, just stop what you're doing. And here's a total new process, tools, systems, and all the rest. Have you experienced that light switch sort of change?
I have. And if you have the light switch, especially at the executive level, you can almost ensure this is going to get done, because if you have the leadership behind this and they have a real reason, a catalyzing moment or a light bulb or light switch, absolutely. A great example. And we used to have this video on our website, but when our parent company that put a lot of the investment into our product before we were spun out, Kiewit, went through their analysis. The CEO had gone to a job in Western Canada that was in trouble. And he said, I'm flying out there. We're going to take a look at this. And he shows up on the job site and they say, tell me what's going on. And they mentioned some costs. He goes, will you get me the monthly cost report? And he goes, it was 1,500 pages long. Just the cost report. And this was about 2010. And he goes, how can I do anything with this? This is just an archive that goes into a folder with maybe one important page. How can I dig anything? And that was the light bulb that came on for that organization, says we have to do things differently. And wisely, it wasn't, I'm going to go out and buy a system that's going to solve all my problems. It was a true procurement, a true internal understanding of what they wanted to do. What did you, it was that last planner. I want to get here to where I have reports and dashboards and analytics and predictability and all these, you know, AI and all these fun things. That wasn't a thing at the time, but you were hearing people in game. Well, let's back up and figure out how we're going to get there. And it came down to saying, we're going to have to do this. And senior leadership had to own that this was going to happen, or you will get groups within organizations that will resist the change. Maybe they don't want to learn a new tool. Hey, look, I get it. Maybe I've always been successful, I think, doing it this way. You know, I'm a good golfer. Why am I going to destroy my swing with the hope that it become a better golfer if I'm happy? So a lot of people are afraid to have that change. But I think the most successful ones happen if you have that moment, a major loss on a job that puts you under for the year, or a report that can't solve it, or sometimes an accident on a job site, or a huge hole in a tender. But usually that is a critical step for success. If not, you need to make sure you have the confidence and the intention behind it to stand no matter how tough it gets.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you're right. And you're covering it quite nicely too. I guess, share with those listening what the pitfalls might be of either way. But if we unpick that a little bit, because I guess there's a cost to everything, right? And when I don't mean a monetary value necessarily. Yes, there is a monetary value cost, but there's a cost to doing things fast, and there's a cost to doing things slow. And in your experience, what is the cost of either of those?
Well, I have seen implementations where they know they need a system and they go out, even if they take their time and they coordinate it and they go through a procurement and they make their selection and they set their deadlines. If they didn't do their proper understanding as to really why are you doing this? Yes, we need to get off whatever expired system or spreadsheets or too much paper in my office. Yes, there's something like that. But what you really need to do is look at what in the organization needs to change and why. And so there are some that get started, and if they haven't got together as an organization and gone through why they're doing this and even looked at maybe standardizing processes, there's many times that work has to be done inside the operation before they can think they're going to go and digitize it. Otherwise, we find many times, hey, Mike, we got to put this implementation on hold. We need to reevaluate everything we're doing because we got into your workshops and found out that Val and Dale and Mike run departments and they do it all different ways. So how are we going to come to a consensus? Well, they can come to a consensus while we're in the room. That could be problematic, or they can say, well, go back, let's do that. So I've seen ones that know what they're going to do and have developed their processes and feel confident with their SOPs. Those ones have more success. The other ones, especially the target dates. What happens, our technology usually doesn't slow anybody down in hitting their deadlines if we think the schedules are realistic. Organizations realize that they all of a sudden stumble across the fact that they have different standards in different departments and garbage in, garbage out. If you don't track and enter appropriately and follow in a way that can gather the data, then how good is that data at the end to compare your successes, your traditions, your results, your KPIs, if everybody does it differently? Benchmarking, even stuff with AI, there needs to be some data that's got some standard approach to how it's used. So I think that's one of the most dangerous things is if you haven't really looked at your organizational process, that's a bit of an issue. We'll help with that. Trust me, you want to come with us because of our experience. We have best practices. We have ideas. But then you need to be open-minded to say, we want to hear what you have to say so we can become better. If you come in and say, hey, we want to do it our way, and they don't realize there is one our way, then you have some internal battling that needs to be resolved. And that's one that can really disrupt momentum and even affect the final, you know, whether or not it implements. That could kill the whole project. It really can.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's not too different to the consulting world, I guess. And Val and I have spoken about this where sometimes you've been brought in for a bit of advice on, you know, what's wrong and why things aren't working. And one of the first questions you sometimes ask clients or sponsors is saying, well, if you're part of the problem, are you open to hearing that? And it's interesting to see their response. But it's a really interesting point you bring up. And I'll ask you one more, and I'm sure Val will bite after you answer this one. But if I say the word, because you brought it up, spreadsheets, Excel, huh? what profanities come to your mind?
I'm going to be honest with you. You know, years ago, our company put out, this is probably, 15 years ago, we said, replace your spreadsheets. And that was when we were selling just estimating and project execution. And it was on-premise. And it was a good campaign. And we realized what we were up against. This was still in the pre-SaaS days. This was a few iterations ago, certainly a generation of the technology ago. And we realized that no matter how you shook it, you weren't getting away from spreadsheets. So years later, we came out and said, leverage your spreadsheets. We actually kind of made the point of saying, look, we acknowledge they're not going anywhere. And even today, we do some of our imports and exports via spreadsheets. We let clients upload templates. We might pull in BOQs. I think the key thing is to say, look, it's all right to have dessert. Just don't overeat. It's that sort of thing. It's still an important part of your day, but it shouldn't be driving your massive multi-billion euro operation. It shouldn't. It needs to be used appropriately and recognized. And so I actually I don't even have a love-hate relationship with them. I use them all the time, and I want to genuinely say people are going to use them, but it shouldn't be the core tool that drives your business at the value you're doing. There's too many mistakes and holes and things it can't do. So you're missing out, really. Other than the error-prone nature, you're missing out.
I was going to say, then I think a lot of people are having too much dessert there, Mike, because you know, there's an obesity epidemic on projects with spreadsheets, I think. And in terms of adopting, I think that you did the right thing, and I think a lot of people are realizing that there is a place for spreadsheets. It's this malleable data set that you can run all sorts of theories on, but it's a temporary element. I think when people construct housing around it and start to do smart stuff, then it becomes a problem, because now you're becoming your own in-house software engineer. And when things need to change or something, you know, the dangerous thing I think I've ever seen is just one cell didn't copy over, that kind of thing, you know, compounded errors. Well, and it happens all the time.
All the time. Well, a guy leaves the company and the spreadsheet's on his laptop. Of course, that was before 0365, but that was a thing. They, oh my gosh, where did that sheet go? Or it's linked to a field in another spreadsheet that got saved to another folder. No. Oh, it's, you know, you're absolutely right. We've had cases. So a lot of times with our clients in the early stage, even before they made a decision, they're like, hey, can I give you my current BOQ or my current worksheet to put my data in your system so I understand what it looks like? Absolutely, we love to do that. I can't tell you how many times we do that. And about 2 weeks later, we call up and say, hey, we're ready to run this demonstration, but you have a major error in your spreadsheet. You have a field that didn't add up that was, you know, $250,000 Canadian dollars short of what you bid. And they're like, oh, no. Yeah. And so it's, I feel bad. It's a bit gratifying to know that, look, this is why you need something like this. You feel bad that it happened, but sometimes it's that light bulb that says, oh, geez, I can't do this again. Right. So you're exactly right. They're a nightmare when used inappropriately. And fortunately, there's a lot of companies still doing that. So I have business out there, right? They're our biggest competitor, to be honest with you, right? I mean, that's probably the most prominent tool still to this day across organizations is these spreadsheets that are so error prone.
Well, I would imagine in your line of business, that would actually be an indicator of interest, because it's a symptom. Excel is a symptom of something's broken internally from my perspective. So probably that last word, interoperability, is probably an issue if they are still using spreadsheets to get themselves from, you know, application A to application B. There's something that happens in the middle. It's also used as a safeguard. The other way I've seen it used or abused is between the client and the contractor. And the reason they use it is because the real figures, if the client found out about the real figures, Mike, geez, we'd be in trouble, right? Contractually, commercially, whatever you want to call it. How do you deal with that when it comes to systems and tools? Because tools obviously promote transparency. Interoperability means you have a full view and a lens. How do you deal then with the client interface when commercial, contractually, you are not in a good position? And just imagine you're the contractor, and this has happened to me, and I'm sure Dale's got a few experiences. What do you do then? Because sometimes leadership, they have two kind of agendas, right? One of them, 100%, they want to deliver the project. If they're a good leader, they want to deliver the project on time, on budget, whatever the triangle is. The other one is they want to protect the interests of the company they work for. How do you do both of those on a project when one of those metrics isn't quite on target?
Oh, you're absolutely right. One of the challenges out there is people don't want to be transparent. They've known that they can move forecast money that they're winning to an item they're losing to pick it up and say, look how good I am. And yet it's all because one item did so well for one reason or another, and they kind of bury it. So spreadsheets and even systems can do that. Now, the auditability of ours, for example, if someone did do something like that, you might need workflow approvals to do it, which limits its capability. But even if you did something underneath it, there's auditability. So that is truly a problem. And I think some of the more long-standing people on older spread, you know, been using the same spreadsheets for a long time, they know how to do that. And they might be some of the ones resistant. When I talk about change resistance and end user adoptions, there are people I've seen that you could tell that's one of the reasons that they're resisting it, is that they know that we're quickly going to expose it. But to your question specifically about the different stakeholders, one of the successful approaches we've seen recently, we did some things in our system that allow it. So it's one of the few that could be used by an owner on a job. So we have owners all over the world. We have PMCs and consultants, some of the biggest names in the world, using us on projects. And of course, we were originally built for contractors. So the ability to get very granular and daily productivities and quantities and crews and all these things that tell you how am I doing in my man hour variation every day, right? So because those tools were built into it, as you scale it up the stakeholder pyramid, you have the ability to use or not use those. Well, we were recently selected, middle of last year, on a project in Norway for a new airport they're building up above the Arctic Circle in Bodø. And that one actually has got a new contracting model that I've seen a few more times. But the idea is that there is the contractor agrees to share in, it's a risk reward sort of contract base. Those can only be really successful if you have full transparency. And so while we could put security and hide fields and data and produce results that only show what an owner should see that a contractor's performed to have the real data, this idea of having the two share with a consultant in between, the idea of having the two share in this so that if they can do really well, they are going to be benefiting mutually. And then if there's a big issue, they are going to be sharing in responsibility mutually. That contracting model's been around forever. Datas and platforms and technology are making it more confident and trustworthy. And I think bringing a new energy to that business. And so part of it comes down to, is there a trust amongst the three groups in that big program to either see the data, hope they're not finding the data, or you know, limit it, only show the roll-ups. Maybe that's what you do. Don't show anything on the profit side, show the totals against price versus against cost. But the more you're willing to trust and share in that, I think the more in this day and age, you're going to need that to keep things from overruns and hopefully avoid changes and working together, partnering to get through challenges that come up in every major project.
Yeah, that's a good one, partnering. I might lead into my next question around, you know, when I think about projects, I think about all the different types of applications, and it's always a seaboard. It's never like from the same menu. Like some of it's, you know, you've got a little bit of seafood there, maybe a little bit of Chinese, a little bit of, you know, Middle East. It's not the same menu. It's not the same recipes. You got completely different configurations. And largely, I think the projects I've been on that are long projects. I think like 5-10 year projects, or even longer. When we get involved, because obviously Dale and I work in the consulting world now, it's usually when things are not going well and they need an external experience to shake things up. And you go in there and you say, do these talks, you know, talking about interoperability and scalability and modularity, how do these things talk to each other? And so you're mapping the as-is and you're doing a current state analysis. What we're finding is there is this slow shaping of most products and tools that are talking to each other, even if they're not native. So, you know, product A will talk to product B. There are a lot more direct connections now instead of export imports. I think software companies as a whole kind of industry for project management are starting to realize they need to offer that as a service, because we can't just expect a project, especially when they've got legacy systems, to just adopt the full suite of programs from one provider, which arguably would be the idea to do that at the onset. Dale and I have had many conversations about bringing project controls into the bid phase rather than the delivery phase so that we can help set up the delivery phase. What's your experience in terms of talking nicely with others? Do you think that the trend or the industry for software as a service or platform as a service programs or applications, they'll start to talk and merge all together with a nice transition using the same language? Are we getting to that level of maturity?
We're getting closer. I think, you know, one of the challenges we have, and it ties back to the earlier part about user adoption and new systems, is there's still a lot of people that are comfortable in a 20-year-old solution or some in-house product, and they're a little nervous about changing, especially on the tendering side, changing a new tool. But I'm very confident when I turn in my tender here, so they're nervous to do it, okay? Well, as those products slowly expire out, a lot of limitations in those products prohibit real good interoperability, right? So as Innate has done is we have APIs everywhere and we're like, hey, look, we'll give you the APIs. We'll maybe rely on a third party to build those connectors, but we'll make our APIs available to everybody and decide where do you want to connect and what do you want to do with it? And so to me, that is where the technology is going, provided that it's compatible, which newer stuff is, but it's some of the older legacy stuff that some people are afraid to leave. And that becomes the resistance. So we get in with a few of our solutions, our modular approach to a challenge. and we need to touch three or four other systems, it always comes down to, well, that system's 25 years old, and I don't believe they have an export other than a spreadsheet that's really going to help send us their data. So we'll do it, but understand the limitations. It's that's the creaky old bridge, you know, and it might be better to find another way to connect the two with a smoother, you know, superhighway connecting them. And so we're kind of in the superhighway approach. And then that's going to be custom for everybody. And we have some canned integrations, but the reality is most of the products we're talking to, or many of them, are used in their own unique way. So the only way to make that work is we'll pop a bunch of data through an API up to a web service or a middleware. They'll do the same, and the middleware will massage it, and maybe a consultant we'll hire to come in and do that. That to us is really what we believe the only customization that should be done in an implementation. What happens in a lot of products is they either can't do much or they can do absolutely anything you want. And so you tend to customize the solution. Well, you go to customer A and customize some phenomenal features, a new way to do NEC4 or some sort of workflow that's just phenomenal. Wouldn't it be nice to leverage that to contractor B when they get wind of it? And that is an approach we took. We said, if we're going to build stuff into the tool, it's the commercial product. So the next person has access to the original way and the new way. And then someone else comes in and we're like, yeah, we could add that feature. And then everyone's got access to that. So when we get in there, you're configuring stuff. So it's unique to your business process or some special ways, but it's not custom. And so I think the ability to take from one user experience to the next benefits the market, knowing that the APIs will likely need to be customized almost every time, because I can't tell you what tool that ERP system, what table they're using for this field. And so we believe it's down to that. That's the part we like to focus the customization on. 95% of it should be ready to go.
Yeah, that's awesome. I actually think as well, you know, and I'm not the expert. I mean, from my limited perspective, you know, this wave of AI adoption seems to have hit, at least from a consumption perspective, some critical mass ground, not necessarily implementation, but definitely awareness kind of phase.
Yeah.
And one of the things we floated with Dan Patterson when he was on board was about, you know, this almost this autonomous operation from a this episode is sponsored by Deltek, your gateway to peak project performance and profitability.
Deltek's world-class PPM solutions offer robust cost control, customizable workflows, scalable scheduling, and advanced risk analysis.
Trusted globally by thousands, Deltek drives your project success to new heights. Discover more at deltek.com. From a third party being an AI or a machine learning type screen, a canvas, if you will, that was blank, but had the intuitive programming to kind of reach out and connect with other systems without intervention. And I was thinking about it like a synapsis, you know, like two neurons kind of finding each other and then connecting, you know, neurons that fire together, and it's seeking out connections on its own. How far are we from like an autonomous blank screen kind of development system that builds based on the inputs and maybe some probability based on previous programs, based on some deterministic data on the environment, the location, et cetera. How far are we from something like that?
I mean, I think on paper, it could work. So I think there's a couple things that people don't realize when it comes to AI. So we get asked the question a lot. Are you using AI? Short answer is yes. And thanks to Dr. Dan Patterson, when we acquired a product he had designed 5 years ago, it came with AI built in it. It's part of our schedule risk tool, and it does wonderful things with data to make prediction and recommendation on common themes. People say, great, do you deliver all that data with us? And we're like, whoa, you know, we don't. You can populate it with all your P6 schedules. You can build it. It'll learn itself, learn from itself as it goes. So there's this tendency for people to think we can deliver the ready-go model in there. Here's the problem in construction is, and in this day and age with data, we don't own your data, and they can't own your data, right? So we're not taking data from a lot of other companies and building this model because no one's going to give us their data. And we don't ask for it anyways, but people are very private with it. We don't have access to it. Everybody owns their own data. So we can help a company with their own data, but I can't take all of our clients' stuff. You didn't sign some open source thing that says, by the way, if you use the your systems, the data's public. That's what it would take. That's what AI and ChatGPT-4 do, is they use publicly available information. Construction data is by no means publicly available data. Now, you've got companies building libraries from legally obtained and authorized data. And they're starting to do that, like some of the costing support tools and databases that have been built in the past. But a lot of it comes down to that data. And then what I have seen done, and this is where taking your question of, is this possible? Where are we at with that? I know for a fact there's a, you know, Kiewit in North America does that. They put their own machine learning on this massive trove of data that comes out of our system. That's not us. That's them. Clients can do that. They have access to all this data. And they have these like 12 machine learning engines that they have put on top of that data that are being used to anticipate, based on history, projects that may end up having the greatest risk. And it's affecting their decisions at bid time. Like they're changing the way they approach the business, the market, the industry, based on, I call it, it's not the needle in the haystack, it's the needle in the needle stack. I mean, you are so much deeper than just saying, look at this great KPIs. It's going in and finding an even more important, as we said, hey, it's good to know this, but did you know that it's a result of this? And I'm going to suggest that you're probably going to end up with one of those losses. And so I think companies that whatever systems they use, if they can be smart about how their data, different systems or one system come together and is accessible, they can do almost entirely that. I think that, like I said, the technology and a prototype is there, and there are examples of it. I just think it's hard to think that any one vendor is going to do that. You slap AI on somebody's tendering tool, how does that help me in predictability? Okay, slap it on the predictability, but how does that help me tendering? So it's going to be coming, I think, initially with the experimentation of the larger companies or the smarter companies, don't have to be large, that have been smart about their data. So it starts with data. You get that, I think there's a lot that can be done with it. But if you put it on the burden of the vendor every time, I don't know that that's necessarily going to provide, you know, a generational change. That's at least that's what I'm seeing when I talk to these companies. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. If I jump in there again before Val gets carried away too much there, Mike, I do agree with you totally. And I think data or data for the American audience is really, really a contentious issue. And if I sort of weave that into an area we touched on earlier on, I guess the supply chain, because let's face it, on most of the projects we're working on, there's a supply chain, right? There's the contractor, the subcontractor, sub-subcontractor, etc., etc. And if we do aim to have everyone working in the same ecosystem, right? Where do you stand on that? Do you believe that the entire supply chain that's delivering the project should be in the same tool set? Or do you think that it should be separate?
No, I don't think they need to be in the same tool set. I think they can be, but that's awfully wishful. I think what needs to happen is some of the ways in, it's that API thing, portals, apps, ways to get the bits of data that matter in that can then be read by other systems, I think is the logical assumption. There, again, you may get 80% of the people, or heck, let's reverse that. 20% of the people doing 80% of the work might find utilizing the same systems, but we get more and more people telling us, hey, the owner has required me to use this product for this reason. Can you help me still use that while internally benefiting from yours? We're like, yeah, we have an API for that. And so I do think APIs can help with that. And again, some of these companies in the supply chain, whether it's quoting and vendor catalogs and things like that, you know, the Felixes and some of the smart bid nets and some of these other products that are out there do a good job of doing that. And I think they network effects is what more and more people are using it. I think that's possible. Then you find somebody new comes along with a newer technology and people peel off. It's always the danger. I think APIs, at least naively, I think APIs are one of the best solutions to that. But it's going to be hard to get there 100% because of just, I use Mac, I use PC, I use Chrome, I use Edge, I'm in Android, I'm in iOS. You're always going to have multiple ways to have to do something. And if one technology doesn't keep up with another, then all of a sudden there's a break. So, but I do think that there's ways to come close to achieving that and not requiring you all be in the exact same product at the same time.
Yeah, and you're right. I think APIs are a great gateway for products to communicate with each other. I guess the other challenge for organizations is, do we have the capability? Do we have the people that can actually design these solutions using these APIs? And that's the next challenge. But I want to touch on the data. Regardless of if everyone's working in the same tool set or not. If you're working on a project that ultimately there's a client and usually it's government, who owns the data for that project that's being delivered? Is it the contractors and the supply chain, or actually is it the government because it's their project?
I'm going to make sure I don't get in trouble from our contracting department for my interpretation of that. But from our side, it comes down to who the client is, right? So if I sell a solution to Transport for London, in our eyes, they owned the data that's in our system. Now, they likely have some sort of pass-through usage agreement to their contractors and consultants to say, hey, you're going to use our system, but we own the data. If I sell the system to a consultant or a contractor, then that contractor is putting their own data and managing their subs and maybe their supply chain, and they have a similar flow through. So I think from the point of the client down, we mostly see that data owned by them, and they have control over who enters the data. We can't do anything, but that's it. Now, if they want to go above and share it outside of their rules, that's up to them, and maybe they have their own contracts. But we always look at it as the contractor down. So you've got the owner, you've got the consultant who may be coming in from the side. He may not have an oversight per se. So there's probably some agreements, but if a contractor is working for TFL and the contractor has a bunch of their own data, I believe the contractor owns that data in the sense that it's their machine, it's their resources, it's their manpower, it's their quantities and their schedule. And they would own that information. If the owner interprets it differently or gets a flow up in their system, they own that data. And then it's up to the company to see what the laws are with respect to their employees, right? Because that's where I run into it more than anything is take GDPR, for an example, is the company's interpretation. There's some loose areas in that law there that give a little bit of, decision-making on what they think defines as personal data. And so then it comes up to the company to decide that, and now you're at a whole nother level. So I look at it as a client, but that could be a naive vendor's perspective. I'm sure it goes much deeper in the government and IT departments, but that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, and I don't think we've cracked the nuts. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here, because there's this huge, I think there's value placed on data ownership. And me personally, I actually don't think that's where the value lies. I think the value lies in what insights you can extract from the data rather than owning the data, because purely just owning a car doesn't mean that you're getting the best out of it. It's how you drive it, you know, how efficient you are. Do you know how to, you know, get the best out of the vehicle? So that, I think, where the true value lies. But we'll let that debate carry on and see how that pans out. The other one that I want to bring us, I guess, back to is, if we just get back to the topic, what are some of the barriers to scalability? Because I can imagine that for different organizations, you can't just go out there and scale. And I know one of the things you said earlier was, well, you need to have a plan and you need to understand, you know, what it is you want to do with the tool set and the advantages you have with, I guess, scaling these solutions up. But are there others other than just having a plan?
Absolutely. Let's start with scalability at the sense of a big organization, maybe a multinational. Certainly borders can totally affect it. For instance, you may not be able to take a data center and move that data outside of a specific country, region, zone, EU, US, Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of rules like that. So if your organization's in multiple countries and you would like to be able to see KPIs across it, you may have a challenge unless you find some other secondary way to take copies of that data out, right? So I would certainly say one of the biggest scalable things is crossing the borders in the sense of what the data laws and capabilities are. Bandwidth across one server, bandwidth across the world. We have a few clients using one data center and hitting it across the world. And, you know, you hope that they're in an office environment that gives them a decent speed of the internet, or they could be really pulling, because a lot of people don't realize it. These data centers we connect to wirelessly have undersea cables. I mean, it's not like this stuff could just be infinitely sent through the air, right? There is a length of cable that can affect this, right? So that to me is certainly one of the scalables. Another one is depending on how you're scaling it. I mentioned earlier, Are you going from one business unit, region, or department to another? And do they do things differently? So I have some companies I've worked with across the Nordics, and each of the countries there does things differently. They have their own national standards, their own traditional work processes. And so when you get the two of them in the room and they're trying to standardize on a coding philosophy or even just a tracking philosophy, they may bump up against it. And so they realize, hence the reason to maybe pause and say, how are we going to do this? So scalability is great. If I take the example of modularity at the beginning, where I just start with a project and a group of motivated people that have no preconceived notions and they find this optimal way to do that, there could be a challenge scaling that up if other projects, other people, other clients are expecting or needing things done differently. And then the third is just, well, I guess it's merged the two together. The third is the individual people. So you have the processes and methods, you have the individual people. So it almost comes down to your people, process, technology, right? It's each one of those has a scalability challenge that you hope you know to, you know, going in so you can prep the implementation team, but they all have their own scalability issues. Small little group in one office in two cities. Oh, okay. That's very easily scalable, but it definitely is a thing that I hope in the next 20 years is less of a thing. But people are coming off a bunch of disparate systems, a bunch of disconnected ways. Val's love for spreadsheets is certainly a problem because everybody has their own way of calculating that thing in a spreadsheet. So that certainly has created problems that I'm hoping in time will go away.
Yeah, no, that's great you share that, because I think a lot of the listeners thinking about, you know, if they did want to scale, you know, what sort of some considerations they require ahead of time to unpick. And the good thing is that you brought up internet speeds and things like that, because Val's always had issues and he's in Australia, always, which is supposed to have always good internet speeds. How are you doing there, Val?
I'm still here. I'm listening very closely. I had a question, Mike. Hopefully you can hear me still, which is really around probably what, because you've been around projects long enough, you know, what's the most impressive thing I think you've seen in the software market to date or that's coming? What's really going to blow the socks off? Because ultimately what we don't want is iterations. I think what we're ready for is like a big change, a big shift. And I think if you can get, from what I can see in the market, most people are getting ready for something. They're kind of, from the conversations I have with clients, this is how it goes. What do you offer in AI? And we talked about that earlier, but AI is just one component of a kind of larger shift, which is I'm almost thinking or smelling that they're ready to let go of control to a degree, right? And obviously there's a level of trust that comes with that because we talked about data, et cetera. But if we can tick all the boxes and AI can do what it says it can on the box, are we moving into something a bit more special? So back to my original question, what's really getting you excited, Mike, in that realm?
You know, these are tough ones to go through, but I'm going to just take my current business out of this answer, because you could go all day on the AIs and the virtual realities and all these things. That doesn't excite me in the same way that new building materials and building methods does. I love what the potential is for. I did some work about 8 or 10 years ago, and I was looking for some new technologies, and I was finding a company in Florida that made algae-based concrete, you know, which is better for the environment, that was lower cost, that, you know, cured faster and was stronger. And it sounds very, you know, utopian in that sense, but it's real. The problem is, that's got a scaling issue because people tried and true, they know their PCC, right? They know their Portland cement. So get that first building zoning community willing to say, I'm building 3 high rises with algae-based concrete. No one's doing it. I think it's right for that. I think new methods of approaching the metals and the environment and the way they build their buildings. And I think there is elements of 3D printing and robotics. It's not an end all be all. I love modular building. I love the ability to build something in a factory and deliver it over a 3-day weekend, build the whole 12-story office tower with minimal site disruption. So I think there needs to be more attention put on some of these prototypes and technologies. I have personally seen work on small scale. I would love to see that work on a bigger scale, but I don't know that a lot of agencies and builders have the stomach to be that guy. It's one thing to be the first on a new technology platform and try AI here. It's another thing to go that path. But I truly think that's where we're going to see the next big leap, is in that kind of materials building process, and robotics is part of that, right? How they can, you know, use it to build brick and shoot stucco and do some of the traditional stuff that might be more repeatable.
Yeah, I'm with you, Mike. I think we get stuck in the whole the classroom zone where we're kind of talking about the office suite and how we manage projects from a methodology perspective, but what makes real ground and what makes truly remarkable shifts in the construction industry is changes on the ground. And I think there's something around future projects being a lot more conscious of the environment and sustainability. And we're seeing that come in with ESG and various other methodologies to help govern and constrain how, because again, transport in particular, transport infrastructure has a huge impact on the carbon footprint of each country. And especially when a lot of the Western countries are in a kind of a capital spend. We've got a lot of infrastructure projects in Australia, for example, and we haven't got any metrics. We do have metrics, but we're not using, I mean, metrics is one thing, right? And carbon offsetting is another. But what we really want is different methods and different ways of working that have a footprint on the ground. So again, you mentioned materials, for example, which is a great one. How we logistically get things to site and from site. Prefab is one idea, but what else could we do? Robotics and like autonomous ways of building things is another way to reduce impact, and as well health and safety. I think it's actually something we don't talk about enough. We should get someone on the pod, Dale, because this is an area where you could go down the rabbit hole for a good hour at least. But Mike, what do you think about that?
I think it's great. I mean, I see constantly, every couple of years, a McKinsey, a Boston Consulting Group, somebody comes out with a really nice report on improvements in this $20 trillion U.S. dollar global sector of the economy, and says, if you could do all these things, there's a 50% chance, or there's a chance of 50% productivity improvement, right? You then also see the global footprint of building materials and transport, and even things like coking processes and burning and melting in your steel mills. I'm seeing and reading studies all the time. Not only would it be good for the environment, I think it would look good politically. And I also think there's a chance to revolutionize and do some of this stuff in a very smart way. You see, NEOM's trying a lot of those things in Saudi, but are they going to scale? We'll see. That maybe is what you need, is to have that level of high profile project with investment. But I truly believe it. And I think people tend to look at the obvious things in front of you, your petrol vehicle, your water heater, your air conditioning unit, as things that are going to change the environmental effect of our everyday activities. And I don't spend enough time talking about the construction material business. They also probably don't look at, you know, cattle and things. I mean, there's a lot of different elements of it. There just tends to be a focus on that. But building materials to me is one that there's some things that need to be done, probably invested in, maybe put a little bit more than is today to test, improve, and scale this stuff, because that is an issue in so many different ways. Life cycle, lifetime management of these assets as well. It would have benefit in so many different ways. I'd like to see it. And I think having more talk about it and stuff, your show would be a great one to kind of bring a variety of guests on to talk about different elements of the construction sector that could benefit.
There we go. We've put it out there. The challenge is on. But I also think as well, maybe it's the way we think in construction, especially if you've been there too long. We think in, like, maybe modularity is the wrong way to think about it. Just for a second. Maybe what we need to do is a bit like the British cycling team. There's a guy called the coach, Dave Brailsford. I don't know if you heard of this approach. It was called the 1% marginal gains. And so he helped them win the gold medal for the Olympics. But what he did is he looked at every tiny facet. And this is kind of how we run projects. We look at everything differently. Like from project control's perspective, we want to change things by 1%. And 1% change here and a 1% change there and a 1% change over there adds up, right? These 1% add up to a compound effect. And so it could be that we change the material 1%. We change something over here 1%. Rather than going with the big bang solution, because I think when we get into this routine of thinking there's something that's going to come along, again, not talking about AI, but generally we have something that BuzzFeeds us and there's a hit word. We think it's going to solve all our problems. But arguably, even if we had the best software in the world, Mike, and it was all connected and we had APIs and everything was directed and everyone was trained and we had great leadership and everyone was on board, I guarantee you we still would have massive issues in delivery. And it's because it's one, as Dale will tell you, these are unique endeavors. Each project's a little bit different. Two, they are a lot bigger than they used to be. You mentioned NEOM. I mean, these are $500 billion projects at a time happening in concurrency in the same region. And then you're talking about breaking the rules of architecture and aesthetic design and engineering. So you're creating novel problems already. It's great if you've got a cookie cutter project like you're building a shed or a manufacturing unit with an assembly line. These things can be predictive and they can be, you can use things like Lean and Six Sigma and you can obviously optimize efficiency really easily because you know the front, the end, and the middle. So the inputs and the processes and the outputs, the whole PMBOK approach is easy. But when it comes to these novel events, I think the only way you can really change variables is by doing it 1% at a time. What's your view on that?
I think when you look at the whole scale of construction, you're absolutely right. I think a good example is admixtures to concrete, not replacing the concept of Portland cement. And can you get it? There is fuel mixes that have done a similar thing, right? So no, I believe that bringing one robotic autonomous piece of equipment onto a job and see how that does and chip away and say the next project I'm bringing two. And you look at the mining sector in some areas and in Canada and in South America, they're running all the scrapers, giant, some of the largest machines in the world are run autonomously. So I do think that that's a smart approach. I also think that each company, and this takes me back a little bit to data, one of the pieces of the technology and the analytics that I see having the biggest value is these heat maps. If you've ever seen the Power BI heat maps that can take, say, for example, productivity combined with size of the task or value of it, combined with percentage left to complete. And so it can quickly, using the needle in a haystack approach, can pop up onto the screen in greens and reds and bigs and small boxes, size of the line across it. It'll immediately tell you where your greatest opportunity to recover money or improve is. And to me, that actually is kind of the opposite approach. But with that, it says, oh my gosh, I've been spending time going through all these tasks, trying to get cycle times a little bit faster on the highway when I realized that the pipe crew is doing something completely wrong. And so as much as the bigger things can go 1%, I think analytics and those that aren't leveraging it and those that want to leverage it, that's a huge game changer in profitability to find out, I've only got five things I'm struggling on. Hey, how am I doing on those on other jobs? You make a small tweak to your crew, that can be substantial. That realizes you're pedaling wrong. And all of a sudden your bike speed is, wow, I wasn't using my muscles appropriately. And there's a lot of that out there, a lot of it. I don't think they have to lose as much money on some of these jobs. And those are where we see the most. We talked about modular and quick return on value. We recommend a couple tools that can more immediately fix something you didn't know was a problem. And it'll be a game changer. So they see the value of their investment right away. So I do think it takes both of those. A couple quick wins at a micro level. At a macro level, yeah, you're talking percentages. Absolutely great. I think that's a great, great approach.
Yeah, awesome. I also think, I was just talking to Dale offline before, and we've talked about it as well, is having this ideas factory. Like, how do we take some, because I actually know for a fact, and I think this is actually just proven in my own experience, but 99% of people who work on projects know where the project's at. Like, what happens when people get freaked out and they see this in the news, in the headlines, HS2 is delayed. If you asked any of the people who are actually on the ground working, they would have told you, yeah, we knew that. They knew. So they knew it before too. I'm not saying they knew then. They knew like with some time, particularly those that have roles in controls and development and analysis and risk. And we knew. And so when we apply these kind of ideas, we talk about scalability, modularity, and interoperability. I can't even say it now. See, Mike, you've got me stuck. Interoperability.
I do. I'll have you memorize it by the end of the day.
I just wanted to say mate at the end of it. My Australian slang just kicked in. But what I really wanted to do is talk about this ideas factor. How do we get great ideas funneling into something that we can then test and apply? Because what you're saying is true. And a lot of construction companies, I'm sure, would love to test things, but it's expensive. There's a high percentage of failure on a lot of these things that we say we want to try. And then because of the scale of projects, if you have the wrong idea and you scale it, you have a big problem. So there's this kind of concern of like testing and trialing. But imagine if we had an ideas factory, Mike. How do we kick this off? I'm just spitballing here, but how do we do this?
You know, it is a good question. I'm thinking to times I've seen new improvements in a power turbine and for a wind turbine for power generation, or I've seen over the years interesting desalination technologies. I think some people are entrepreneurial enough and maybe they invest their own sweat and money. I do think there's an opportunity through universities, grants, maybe some of these larger donors. If you can show the upside, you look at, I'm trying to remember her full name, but Jeff Bezos' ex-wife, when they split up, she has a whole new approach to philanthropy. She's giving away money like anybody on the planet has ever given away in history. And one of them is because she's not expecting detailed analysis up to the date of how every dollar is being spent. She's kind of trusting that there's a term for it, but she's trusting that they're going to go use it and there's no strings attached. And I think that it would be great to see some of those approaches applied. I mean, yes, maybe it doesn't look as soft as medicine and pharmaceuticals and things like that that are important to donate. But you are talking about, again, about a fifth of the global GDP is involved in this sector. Could we get some really nice donations used and maybe an incubator or a innovator program to where money can go in to test these things? And if you get to a certain point, maybe there's an opportunity through government grants or other donors to do that. And I've always liked the Bill Gates approach, is that he invests in something that he can actually take a stake in. It's different than Bezos, but it looks at hey, I could profit from it. So there's more of an incentive to invest. You get more of their attention and mindset and brain power, and they see it as, wow, if you could really scale up this power generation or desalination technology, and the end result is this, you could get ongoing chunks of money, because now it's no longer just a donation, have at it. It's someone with deep pockets investing in a profit model. And I feel that you can't just expect everything to be done with donations, but not all businesses and people have access to, okay, I can get you a couple $100,000. Now to go to the next scale, I need 12 million. But what's the upside? Maybe there's a value in an intellectual property side of it. So I think we need to find some programs and ways to experiment some of this stuff that on paper looks very doable. Go into the lab and then go from there. And it's been happening, but I just don't feel it's happening at scale at this point. And then you get something like MBS and NEOM saying, I'm willing to throw it at this massive giga project. That's where you do it, is you maybe find a couple mega or giga projects that are wanting to be cutting edge and promote themselves in that way. So I think there's ways to do it, but you got to get a lot of brain trust together and stakeholders to buy in it. And that's usually the hardest. Getting the money is probably not the hardest part, right? Fighting over it and coming with a plan to make money from it probably is harder.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Mike. And hopefully some of those stakeholders are listening to this episode.
Let's get this one out there.
Exactly. Let's get it out there and let's get the brains together and make this happen, because we have some bright minds in our profession. I think the more we pull together to improve the way we deliver projects, the better for all of us. Because ultimately, projects exist to deliver outcomes for humans, for us, the public, right? And so it would be great. But look, we could probably talk to you for many hours, even days, Mike. You're such a fountain of knowledge. And I appreciate that you're open to sharing all of your ideas. And I love the fact that, I know it's difficult, you've been with Innate so long that you talk from an Innate perspective, but I love the fact that you can take the hat off and share freely your thoughts and ideas as well. So we really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But before we let you go, we want to do Fiverr with you, which is a bit of a pop quiz. So quick fire.
Okay.
Questions and answers. There are only five, so we won't keep you too long. So if you're up for it, we'll give that a shot.
Let's do it. Well, what have I got to lose?
Exactly. So question one, what's a hobby or activity that you love that would perhaps surprise some people that know you?
Oh my goodness. Well, I am, after COVID and I relocated my office, I had this plain fireplace behind me. And it was really boring as a backdrop. Now I'm at a guest house right now, so that's not it. And I decided to start putting some pieces of art there that looked good. But I wanted every piece of art or every artwork, didn't have to be a certain medium. I wanted it to have a story that I could communicate if I see it. And so it grew from 1 to 2 to 10. Now I have too many. Well, I literally have grown beyond it. Sometimes I swap a new photo out because the same story has come along. But I think I've really put, I've gotten to know the frame guy at Michael's Art Supply because he's like, what have you got for me today? Oh, canvas from a map. So I've really kind of put a, I don't have a creative eye at all, but if it has a story, there is something that stirs in me and it has fun. So the stuff across my house is the most eclectic styles of art, but every one of them has a story. So I do love to do that.
Awesome. Question two, probably you've answered it already, but I'll give it, I'll say it anyway. Do you have a quirky habit or routine that's a must for your daily life?
Quirky is probably, I'm fairly routine in my mornings. I have to have my coffee and I have to have breakfast. And I'm fortunate I live against a preserve and I live in the desert. So year round, I in Arizona, I'm able to hike right up my hill. So I've got to have all three of those things. If any one of those things missing, I'm off kilter. Wouldn't quite call that quirky, but a lot of people don't need all three of those. If I don't have any one of those, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll know that. So without all three of those things, I'm a little bit off center and swerving on my you know, professional lane for the day.
So we'll know for next time, Mike, if you're off kilter. I'll know exactly.
Absolutely.
Why.
Absolutely.
Question three. If you could embark on any adventure or experience tomorrow, what would it be and why?
You know, I'm going to work forever, but I have become someone who is really into international travel. And I'm constantly looking at the next place to go and having conversations with close friends and colleagues about where have you been, where haven't you been. And I've been fortunate to have been literally at so many places. But now that means that the list I haven't been is even more important. I would love to take a sabbatical, do some of this travel, but actually tie it into what I'm doing. I'm fortunate I travel for work all the time, living in America and running one third of the world in terms of a geographic territory, but I'm working. It's not like I'm sightseeing. I may get an afternoon here and there. I've always loved those travel shows that do some fun thing. I would love to do a building big or something that allowed me, probably for pay, for a production, to travel for 6 months that would allow me to see some great places, some great projects, learn, meet some wonderful people, leverage my experience, tick a few places off my list, but also tie very well into what I do and where my passions are. I still think it's going to happen someday. I just may have to do it on my own in 15 years. So we'll see. I'll keep awesome. You posted. I'll send you a link to the travel show if it ever happens. Or please, I'm first to volunteer. If you take it on the road, I'd let me know.
Yeah, I'll join you as well. I'll hold the camera or something for you.
Yeah, who doesn't have that dream, right?
Yeah, exactly. So here's number four, which is the fantasy dinner party one. If you could host a dinner party with any three people from history or fiction, who would you invite and what would you serve?
You're catching me because I remember not long ago I heard this on a podcast and I'm like, I wonder what I would do. And then I moved past it and now you're catching me. I'm fascinated by Albert Einstein, so I would love to have him. I think, if I go back in time, I don't know of an individual, but I would be very interested in meeting somebody from the Middle Ages of Europe. And I don't know who that would be, but I'm so curious about that period of time and the life cycle. So I'm not saying I want to meet a famous artist. Obviously, we'll go ahead and throw Leonardo da Vinci on there because I love that he's an artist and an engineer and invented so many things. So let's make Leo number two there. And number three, my gosh, I feel like I should go back to probably a founding father, maybe a Thomas Jefferson. I loved visiting his home in Virginia, and he wrote the Constitution. And one of the things that fascinated me, I love maps. You heard me throw in a canvas map earlier as one of my cool prints. I got really into maps. I'm not a map collector per se, but he has maps everywhere in his Monticello house. And I love seeing old maps because they were based on what people thought it looked like. So they would draw like the eastern part of America, and then everything to the west was squiggly lines because they didn't know. Same thing if you look at historic maps over the last 400 or 500 years, Columbus and since and all of that. I've always been fascinated by what we think it looks like this and how it looks. So Probably Thomas Jefferson. I think, you know, I believe in a lot about what our Constitution did with the foresight that it had in America to predict some things. It's not perfect. Nothing is in any government, but I think there was some brilliance behind it. So I think we'll go with Leo and Einstein and Thomas Jefferson. There you go. How's that?
Great party. Great party.
That would be.
The final one, this is Martin's favorite one. He's not on this episode. Are leaders born or made?
So, I have an interesting perspective on this. When I got my MBA, I wrote a paper on leadership, and I took an approach of it's kind of like luck is where preparation meets opportunity. I think it is literally a combination of both. You can be a phenomenal leader and have done the right things, born into it, family, but no one may ever know because you've never gotten that way. And so I think that you have to have, you have both. And I think if it wasn't for where Martin Luther King was when, you know, you had things in Birmingham, when his timing, his location, he was a true leader, but had he not been there, would he have led the civil rights movement? He may not have, and you would have never known that. So I think it's a combination of both, truly, that you need to be prepared, you need to be educated, you need to have, without the ability to lead, I don't think you can, but then you need a situation that permits you, whether it's at a wartime and you happen to be the president or the prime minister when a war happens, you better be a leader. And if you are, you're going to be a Winston Churchill. But, you know, without that sort of platform and exposure, no one would ever know it. And would they call that person a leader if they didn't have the event that did it? So my answer is it's literally probably 50% each, really.
There we go. No answers or wrong answer on the Project Chatter podcast.
Good. If not, edit these out and pretend like you didn't ask me the questions.
Absolutely. But look, Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you for the best part of an hour. And we thank you so much for sharing your insights and your opinion. I guess just before we let you go, any final thoughts for our listeners?
No, I love listening to this show. I think that we need more of this. I think that these shows, if we can get them to more people in the audience, I'm a believer in just picking up information. I love The Economist. I love miscellaneous podcasts. I pick up news from different sides. I love to read. I think being able to follow along a theme like yours, it can vary each time. I think we need to learn a lot about different things, or a little about a lot of things. And you know, if I can do that by listening to shows like this and pick something up and maybe I can contribute back, I'd like more of these, and would certainly love to come back on again. If you're got a hole in your schedule and want to just chit chat for a while, happy to do it.
We'd love to have you back, Mike, and we really, really appreciate your time. Well, any sure, final thanks. Thoughts from you?
No, thanks, Mike. It's been very, very fun. Hopefully we can get over there and come and visit you sometime. And we love doing these in person and traveling too. So thanks Definitely. For your time today.
Well, it sounds like I just missed you guys last week at the event you were at, or 2 weeks ago in the Project Controls UAE. We're active in all of them. This one kind of came up. We didn't get to participate. But we'll keep each other posted on some of the events we're doing. If we throw any of our customer events, like the one you saw us at in London last November, I'll let you guys know. We'd love to have you come out and maybe a chance to take it on the road.
Brilliant. 100%. That sounds great. It's always a good party as well.
Absolutely.
But look, folks, there you have it. This is the end of this episode. So thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed what you heard, please do help us pay it forward and share a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guest, Mike Paul. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Val, it's bye for now.
Bye.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more- more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.